It's a Thursday. It is damn near the middle of July.
It's the eighth day, Bob. Eighth.
And the hockey season is over.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine that here we are. We're talking about the Stanley Cup being given out, and it's the day after, and it's July the 8th. My goodness. I tell you, the first Stanley Cup final I ever produced, I think we finished on May 14th.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, you'll remember when you'd get into May, one of the things you'd worry about is, you know, literally the ice melting and there being steam in the arena.
Oh, Buffalo. Sure. Sure. Well, the Maple Leafs, and there's tons of Maple Leaf fans that watch or listen. The Maple Leafs won the Stanley Cup in 1967 on May the 2nd.
There you go.
May the 2nd. Now this ago. This was an anomaly because of COVID, but I tell you what, they did their damnedest to get this thing done as quick as possible. And they did it pretty well when you consider what the issues were earlier in the season with teams being put on the sidelines with quarantine. But once we got to the Stanley Cup playoffs, aside from a coach and a couple of players, we did okay.
Well, I know it's ridiculous to even talk about this, but it is quite remarkable. I'm watching the game last night. I'm thinking, here it is, the second week of July, and there's no issues with the ice.
No.
It's 95 degrees outside and humid as hell in Tampa. Mm-hmm. Humidity, as you know, is the enemy of the ice. But technology is so sophisticated now. Even opening and closing doors to let 18,000 people in didn't affect anything. So,
you know, I'll tell you what, just as a bit of a history, the jet ice that the ice maker at Maple Leaf Gardens, Dougie Moore, the late, great Dougie Moore, invented, was the great technology platform that changed this type of thing that you're talking about. Jet ice is used all around the world now because it was so effective in the amount of how it froze the ice, and how it could keep the ice as firm as possible over the years. And it really did happen for the first time ever at Maple Leaf Gardens.
Do the buildings have huge dehumidifiers in them?
Huge dehumidifiers, huge air conditioners. Everybody does. And I'll tell you what, at this time of year, if you have an older building, which doesn't really, they don't really exist anymore, you're bringing them in anyway. I mean, I can't tell you how many times over the last 40 years I've walked into an arena and there are four giant dehumidifiers with giant hosing coming out the side of the buildings, and everybody's saying, make sure you keep the doors closed. But the new buildings, the new technology, the new architecture, as big as buildings are, ice now is not an issue any time of the year. Look, we've had outdoor games in Los Angeles. We have them in Dallas.
You're 100% right. Yeah. We didn't even mention it the whole year.
No.
And I, you know, it's interesting because I watch this curling every once in a while, and I guess it's different with pebble on the ice and whatever, but it's much more sensitive. You get any kind of humidity in an arena when there's curling in there, and it changes the game dramatically. Yeah. And it probably affects the ice similarly in hockey, but we just don't notice it. Anyway, this thing ended
over. Yeah.
About, well, exactly as I expected, in five games. Mm-hmm. And I actually was asked last night during the game, do you think Tampa threw game four in order to win at home? And I said, you can't take that chance. There's no chance they did that. And besides which, they tied the game late and then had a 4-minute power play.
Yeah,
I said they had the misfortune of losing game four. But in the end, they won where they wanted to win. You know, if you'd given them the choice, I think they would have said, well, we'd like to win in four, but we'd rather win in five at home. But don't you think?
Yeah, I do. But at the same time, your original point was get the darn thing over with.
Yeah.
You know, win as quickly as possible, because you never know what happens. I mean, they won the game last night, 1-0. Montreal, in the last 5 minutes of the third period, did have chances to tie it and force overtime. And then in overtime, you never know what's going to happen. And all of a sudden, we're talking about game six at the Bell Center on Friday night. And then it's a question mark. So get the win when you can. Did it look better that Tampa won at home with 18,000 people and people and banging on the glass and the, and Steve Stamkos and his teammates doing the right thing and skating it all around the ice like the old days? That made it look magnificent. But I'll tell you what, they would have taken winning it in four just as well.
Oh, of course they would have. The legacy here potentially is, well, there are two things moving forward. Tampa's team is going to change.
Yes.
It's going to probably change more than this era of success. And I don't know how far back you go. You can go 6-8 years, but
I think you have to go to the, cap, Bob. I think you have to go to 2005 when the rules that play that managers and teams had to run with changed. So in the cap era, if you call it,
but I'm talking about this Tampa team has been good.
Oh yeah.
And essentially more or less together for at least the key pieces for a long period of time. It will change. But will they lose key pieces? Will they lose core elements to this team? Or will they lose numerous bit players, for lack of a better term?
Well, they're not losing their core. They're not. And it speaks to how big their core is, quite frankly. When you think Vasilevsky's not going anywhere, Hedman's not going anywhere, McDonough's not going anywhere, Kucherov's not going anywhere. I mean, they are still going to be a force in the National Hockey League next year. You do wonder about Blake Coleman, who has had two great seasons since being traded from New Jersey. He's an unrestricted free agent. You do wonder about Tyler Johnson. He's from the Pacific Northwest. Does he go to Seattle in the expansion draft? Alex Killorn had a steel rod put in his leg last week and thought he might be able to play in game six. I mean, that's phenomenal. Anyway, Alex Killorn is an unrestricted free agent. The question becomes, Bob, in trying to make everything fit on this in this cap world, and because of taxes in Florida and the tax structure of no state tax in Florida, will guys want to stay there and continue to win and enjoy the lifestyle and really take big cuts in discounts, or are they going to try to cash in?
Several years ago, we all know Stamkos did that exact thing. He was offered significantly more money by the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Lifetime money.
And said, no, I want to. And I mean, his, I think, fiance at the time, I don't think he was married, was a Florida girl, I think, or wanted to be in Florida. And did that have a bearing in it? Sure, it did. But
I mean, even his agent had instructed him to take the Toronto deal. And Steven said no.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, and gave up a significant amount of money.
But here's to me the bigger key to all of this. We watched them go to the Stanley Cup final in 2015. They lost in six games to Chicago. They were a bright light amongst the NHL. They were smaller. They were fast. John Cooper was this glib coach. Well, next year they missed the playoffs.
Yeah.
A couple of years later, they get swept by the Columbus Blue Jackets in the first round. Nobody got removed from their jobs.
No, I know.
Ownership stayed patient. Players that were the core players were identified as core players and were rewarded in the long term. There is something to be said. There is a memo to be written in the National Hockey League by someone to say, hey, you stupid owners, if you believe in certain things, stick with the program. Stick with it. Don't make changes too quick. Don't expect things to happen in 2 years when everybody knows it takes five. And that's Jeffrey Vinnick is regarded as the best owner in the National Hockey League. And that's one of the reasons why, is because he trusts his hockey people and he's very patient.
John Shannon then therefore says, to paraphrase, the Toronto Maple Leafs should not do anything with Kyle Dubas and let him continue to go down the road he's gone down.
One more year. He gets one more kick at the can.
Oh, okay.
But Kyle, the parallels in the amount of time that Tampa has been good and Kyle's been around are comparable. You know, this is Kyle's sixth or seventh year now in the organization. So this is, you know, Austin Matthews was what, a 2015 draft, 2016 draft around there. So it's, you know, it's not overnight, but I do think that I would not be throwing, I would not throw on anybody out right now in Toronto. I'd give them a chance to adapt and learn and grow and see what happens next year.
I apologize. I didn't mean to steer the conversation towards the Toronto Maple Leafs.
You did though.
I know I did. But I apologize. On the Montreal Canadiens side, the consensus seems to be that this is an organization that is probably where Tampa was a few years ago and capable of growing, maturing, learning, and winning Stanley Cups at some point in the near future. I can't buy that.
Neither do I.
I defer to you on that.
No, neither do I. Their young players are good. Their young players are improving. But, you know, their two pillars of success, Shea Weber and Carey Price,
are not going to be around forever.
Are not that young anymore.
And they clearly are their two best players.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what, Nick Suzuki, Josh Anderson, really, really.
Oh, I like Josh Anderson's energy and commitment. And
Suzuki's going to be a star in this league for a long time. I'm not sold on Cole Caulfield.
I don't know if he's going to be a star.
I'm not sold on Cole Caulfield yet, but I
neither am I.
He's good. He's good, but and he can sure shoot the puck. But it's the other parts of the ice. Can he contribute? But I think Nick Suzuki's the real deal. I think they're a long way away. They're the guys that got them.
They're a long way away. But with no disrespect, I think they surprised everybody at the beginning of the year. I've said this over and over, and they surprised everybody at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. In the middle was COVID and everything else, and they did what probably most people thought they would do. That doesn't necessarily mean they're on the road to being a team that can compete for the Stanley Cup repeatedly.
They you know, how they manage their young players now to me is so vital. How do they manage this Romanov on defense? He wasn't good enough to play for most of the playoffs, and then all of a sudden the last two games he was in the lineup and played very well. You know, Jesperi Kotkaniemi. He started the season, he started the playoffs up in a private box, and he finished the playoffs up in a private box. And in between time, he was their second leading scorer. How do you manage him? Those are issues that this organization has to deal with, in addition to trying to find, what do they do with Phil Deneau? Phil Deneau needs a new contract, and we got a flat cap, and the way he played, he's worth every penny that he wants. And I don't know how they're going to afford that.
Yep.
Those are challenges that Marc Bergevin has. Although, I'll tell you what, the challenges Bergevin has right now, Bob, are greater than the challenges he had when the playoffs started and they were down 3-1 to Toronto, because people were calling for his head. And there was a chance that he may not have had an opportunity to sign these guys or draft new players at the end of the month. He was in trouble.
While the hockey season has finally come to a conclusion, the footy fans, especially Brits and those of Italian descent, are all a Twitter about the prospect of the Euro final, which is ahead. And on that note, we will address it with our favorite soccer guy, James Sharman, will join us after these messages. Well, in the midst of Wimbledon and the ongoing Major League Baseball season and the Stanley Cup final and the NBA playoffs, many of our friends have been spending some of their time during the day watching the footy.
Even me.
And I'm positive our guest today has been doing that. James Sharman joins us. So you must be a happy Brit, huh?
Hey, listen, England win and Montreal lose. What a day it was for me on on Wednesday. I tell you, those days don't come around too often, I tell you.
for somebody who, as you know, and I confess all the time, I follow the sport very casually, it's really quite shocking to find out that England has never won this thing. That's really surprising.
And not just that, but never made the final. I mean, this is the first final of any championship in 55 years.
I was going to say the correlations between listening and watching Toronto win and England play soccer, there's a lot of parallels, James.
It's identical. It's incredible, actually. You know, they haven't won since the 60s. 1966,
1967, yep, come
that's
on.
That's right. That's right. A fervent fan base. The fans always hope and think the best. It doesn't happen. Lots of money, but it never comes out, right? And it's an incredible parallel.
Home field advantage has been talked about a fair bit. And, you know, they're playing in the big stadium in London. And is that an advantage, given that these are players that come from all over Britain, England, and may only play once or twice a year at the stadium?
Yeah, no, it's huge. I mean, obviously, during COVID times, it's been odd. The home support's built up slowly from about, you know, 5,000 to 60,000 in the most recent games. England, like most sports, you know, home field advantage is important. It's been a strange tournament because for the first time it was spread around the continent, around Europe, I think in 11 or 12 venues. But England have played 6 of their 7 games and will have at home in Wembley. The one game was Ukraine, they played in Rome. So ostensibly it's been a home tournament for them. And they've really drawn off that. That being said, previous England teams have struggled with that pressure, playing in front of the home support. This team is very different. They seem mentally stronger than previous editions. So, but the bottom line is you can't say it's not a factor. All the teams that played their home games in the home venues progressed the knockout phase. So there's something to it. But hey, you know, every year one team's a home team, right? So
was that Denmark's key? Playing so many games in Copenhagen?
Well, yeah, they played their first 3 games at the Parken Stadium in Copenhagen, but then they traveled. They went to Baku for the last game in Azerbaijan, which is ludicrous. And there's no doubt fatigue took its toll on them on yesterday's match.
That's got to be 7 time zones.
Left.
That'd it's be 7
just,
time
it's
zones.
It's just UEFA doing what they do. I mean, that is a very questionable government as well, right? Very concerning human rights records in Azerbaijan, but UEFA don't care about that. The money came, they paid, they put some games there. There weren't many fans of those games because no one could travel there or wanted to travel there. Very expensive, but that's a sign of, you know, what UEFA does. But yeah, very difficult for Denmark. They were exhausted.
Okay, I'm reading the Copenhagen papers this morning. I'm reading the Daily Mail as well. Apparently, they have a different interpretation of this penalty in extra time. What was your opinion of the call and what VAR did with it?
Listen, it was soft. It was a very soft penalty. The referee called it at full speed. Now, at that point, VAR, so video assistant referee, they can overturn it if they see a clear and obvious error by the referee. There wasn't a clear and obvious error. There was a little bit of contact, clearly. Sterling went down easily. I think he was anticipating contact. Every striker in world football nowadays would do the same thing. I felt bad for Denmark. If it was England on the other side, I would have been very upset. But this happens throughout this tournament, happens throughout every domestic league across the world. That's the way football is refereed. Now, I don't like it. I hate diving. I hate embellishment. I despise it. It's why this game isn't, you know, really getting a firm fan base in North America, I think, because of these behaviors. But that's just the reality. And hey, sorry.
It smelled a lot of game management because earlier in the game, I don't know what you thought, but the Harry Kane in the box was worse.
Yeah, it was. That was a foul. And I was screaming, saying, come on, why wouldn't VAR overturn that? So, you know, in the end, it's like sport. These things come and they go. And in the end, it kind of evens out. I understand why Denmark are upset about it, but it's been, I think we're making way too much of it, to be honest with you. This happens in every league, every tournament across the world.
Well, I want to, since we brought up Kane, or John did more accurately, I want to talk about, I don't know why this occurred to me, but Kane takes his penalty shot. Goaltender saves it. Mm-hmm. Ball comes right back to Kane and he pops it into the net. The idea of a penalty shot with the opportunity where the ball stays live after the shot is a really curious thing. And the only thing I can think of that's comparable is a penalty shot in hockey where, of course, the puck is dead. mm-hmm. immediately thereafter. Which of these two is the right idea?
I think, you know, soccer is always criticized for not having enough flow to it. And this will just, you know, has the flow. It was amazing that the time between that save and the rebound must have been, what, half a second? It yep. felt like a month.
Yeah, it almost bounced right back to Kane.
It did, yeah. Now, it's difficult, but that's why you've got to be switched on. And the defender almost got there in time. Mm-hmm. I like it. You know, I want these games to flow. And it's a penalty. The minute if he makes a save or it hits a post, the game should be live. Continue. Absolutely.
Well, Kane had a head start, so that's one thing.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that maybe Schmeichel, you know, we talk all the time in hockey about controlling rebounds. He's mm-hmm. got to learn how to, I mean, first of all, yeah. It was hard.
I mean, listen, from 12 yards out, it was a poor penalty, in fairness. Usually Kane goes the other side. That's everyone thought. He always goes the other side, and he's very good at it. He buries it. This time mm-hmm. he tried to fool Schmeichel, who knows him very well from the Premier League. And sure, maybe Schmeichel could have parried it away, but I mean, that's not easy, is it? It's hit at some force. Oh. And I think it's just unfortunate. And listen, often the goalkeepers have the advantage in that they can actually leave the line. They're not supposed to, but they have for years left the line before the ball's kicked. Now, VAR has kind of changed that. They're not allowed to, and the camera can catch them. But in this case, he's stuck to his line, made a good save, albeit from a bad penalty, and then Kane was just switched on and got the rebound.
Well, so now let me throw the opposite thing at both of you guys. Should the NHL adopt that philosophy? Unless if the goaltender freezes the puck, stops the puck, catches it, whatever, contains it. All right, so you blow the whistle and there's a face-off. But if it goes somewhere else,
so it pops
back out, and now you have this race of guys presumably yeah. from the blue line. Yeah, that could be kind of interesting.
So can we give the attacking player a 5-yard advantage, for example, and then the chasing pack come following him? That would be amazing. Can you imagine the violence?
So you get to chase him while he's in the
yeah. Otherwise, it's not fair, is it? Otherwise,
sure. Yeah, that and I'll tell you what, as a father of a guy that used to play summer hockey, there's a lot of games that end that way. Shootout with a chase, absolutely.
Really,
that happens. This is something in summer hockey I used to see all the time in summer hockey. In minor hockey, they used to. Yeah, for sure. I haven't been in a minor hockey rink for ages, but they would settle tournaments in the summertime with something comparable to that. And in fact, Bob, what they did is they did that instead of giving penalties. So it would be the shootout. It would be a penalty shot with a chase, as opposed to giving a 2-minute penalty.
So is that because at that level, a power play isn't going to be particularly effective?
I think so. Yeah. And the concept in minor hockey is to get the kids to play. You don't want them sitting in the penalty box for 2 minutes. So, but it's an interesting one. It would certainly
be intriguing. I'd love to see hockey, at least at the AHL level, give it a shot and see what it looks like.
You know, what's interesting. And I want to ask you guys this, you know, I'm watching Euro, the tactical evolution of soccer is pretty obvious, you know, for close observers, right? You watch Italy and Spain play, the game's changing all the time. And you can really, obviously in soccer, you've got a big field, you've got 11v11. You can see the formation's easier than hockey, but it seems that soccer's far more willing to try new things tactically than hockey. I mean, I'm not a hockey guy per se. I'm curious as to your thoughts on that. Is that something that I'm just naive about?
I actually think that hockey has taken a great deal from soccer in the one touch pass. And particularly since in the last 15 years, the removal of some of the lines on the ice when it comes to moving the puck, that long stretch, they call it a stretch pass in hockey. Now you weren't able to do that before. And now you do it, and it also allows you, if you want to relieve pressure, you need the stretch pass, and then you need the player at center ice to tip it so you don't have icing. So I think the one-touch world that we see so much in footy has come to hockey in many, many ways.
Well, I think more accurately, perhaps, Sharman, is you can credit European hockey and the style of play that has been there longer than in North America mm-hmm. for this. If you go back to 72 and that series, the Russians did things that North Americans had never seen before. And that style has been integrated into the National Hockey League to a great extent. I think it's the European influence that has made most of these changes and adjustments.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So let's get down to the nuts and bolts.
Can I ask about the Tuesday game first, Bob?
Oh yeah, sure. The Italy
game? Spain, Italy. I sat there, James, and I thought, gosh, this is inevitable that Spain's going to win. I mean, ball control apparently doesn't mean very much in soccer anymore, as long as you can hold on and then win in kicks.
Yeah, and that's what Spain does, right? And they've done it for a long time now. It's that possession-based football. And, you know, mentioning tactics, Italy have kind of adopted that in recent years as well. They call it, in Spain, it was called tiki-taka when they were dominant back in 08, 10, and 12. And now they're calling it tiki-taka, because Italy's kind of changed it somewhat, and they like the possession base as well. However, in that match, Roberto Mancini, the Italian coach, decided, no, we'll go back to more of our roots. You know, we'll sit deep, give Spain the ball, because we're not scared of them. If you watch Spain throughout this tournament, they've surprised us getting this far, but they've created a lot of chances, but they have no cutting edge, no ruthless goal scorer. And I think that's what Mancini was hoping for. But if you watch it optically, Spain did dominate that game, and Spain, I think, were the better team in that match. But Italy hung on there. And despite, you know, being in the shining light in this tournament so far with their style of play, Italy didn't play well in that match. But they still found a way to win, albeit via penalties. But yeah, it was a fascinating tactical matchup. It really was. And, you know, I feel bad for Spain, but, you know, no one thought they'd get to the semifinals. This is a team very much in transition from the old guard to the new guard. But they've shown that with some clever coaching and perhaps with some more ruthless touch around the box, that they would have been in the final.
Was this classic rope-a-dope?
Yeah, really, yeah. I mean, basically it's called park the bus in soccer, right? You just sit back and it's just that. Sit on the ropes, take the attacks, and then just try and counter them. You know, throw that wild right hook off the ropes and hope for the best. That's kind of what it felt like. But in the end, it worked, I suppose. You know, Italy have a very old veteran defense corps, right? Giorgio Chiellini, Leonardo Bonucci. They've been around the block. They've been around for years. They're grizzled veterans. And I think that's why Mancini could rely on them to get the job done. And like I said, they knew Spain wasn't dangerous in that area. But it almost cost them, right? Spain should have won that game. And, sure, you know, with a world-class striker, that they would have won that game.
We're down to the final. It's England. It's Italy. And we'll talk about that. James Sharman is with us. Take a quick break, back after these messages. With James Sharman, as we take a look at the final upcoming in the soccer thing.
Euro.
Yeah.
That's the one.
Euro.
Well, off the top, is a one-game championship, a one-game final, the best idea? Has it always been thus? Has it ever been a best two of three or, you know?
No, it's always been the way. It's cup football, right? It's knockout football. It used to be that World Cups and European Championships there wasn't even a group phase. The little mini leagues to qualify. It was always knockout football from the off. Even when Denmark stunned the world in 92 and won it, there were eight teams in it, you know, in a knockout format. But it's always been that moment, that cup final. You know, you look at the FA Cup final, 90 minutes should be long enough, 120 minutes maybe with penalties. You get that drama, that theater. You know, people compare it to, you know, over here and, you know, NBA and, you know, all the major sports over here, seven game series, which I love as well. It's just different. You can nurture and embrace those rivalries growing within a series, whereas you haven't got that drama of, you know, everything's out there. It's do or die for that 90 minutes. So both of them work. I love both systems. Neither one's right, neither one's wrong. But for football, for soccer, it's great. There's a lot of football, right? I mean, you can't play more than one game every 3 or 4 days at the most.
Oh, I get it.
So,
what will it mean if if Italy England ends in kicks?
Well, I would have said in the past, it means England lose. But England, if, you know, this current team is just dispelling the myths of the past, you know, or the truths of the past, I suppose, in that they couldn't win the big game. They'd lose penalty shootouts. They were arrogant. This team's different entirely. They're likable. They won that shootout at the World Cup 3 years ago. They've got past the hoodoo of the semifinals. They're really dispelling all those, exercising all those ghosts of the past. So I still think Italy they're not the bookies' favorites, but that's because, I mentioned before, Englishmen are all degenerate gamblers. They throw money at their team. But from an objective standpoint, Italy should be the favorites, just about, but it's very, very close.
I guess my the reason for my question is it going to be one of those where people complain if they lose in penalty kicks, as opposed to, you know, why not let them play another 60 minutes and decide a winner?
Yeah, I've had this conversation a lot with people, and over the years, despite seeing my team lose on so many occasions, I think after 120 minutes, it's time to finish the game. You know, these guys are dead on their legs. There's nothing left. They're cramping up. You have to finish it somehow. And, you know, we see it in hockey quite a bit, don't we? You know, when it comes to, you know, that next goal counts, often they sit back. It becomes very tentative, very defensive, unless, of course, they reduce the number of players in the field, which is an idea. But yeah, I think this is the best way of finishing it. It's not fair necessarily, but if you can't compete and get a result in 120 minutes, then so be it.
So just to clarify here, because I am an idiot, if they go to overtime, they play the full 30 minutes of overtime, right?
Yeah, that's right. There's no goal.
It's not sudden death.
That's right.
Why not?
They've done it in the past, but again, it became so tentative, so defensive. Most of those games went to penalties anyway.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because you'd be so terrified about making that mistake. Teams had just passed the ball around. It was not, as much as you think it would be incredible drama, and it was tense.
Yeah.
But the quality of play wasn't worthwhile. You know, teams are so, so negligent in their attack.
And it is so easy to sit back, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a big field, right? And tired legs.
Yeah. What do you think of Raheem Sterling?
He's a wonderful footballer. And he's done such great things off the field. He is his own man. He has faced the fury of the press more than any other England player. Yeah. He has faced the abuse by those idiots online. And he just rises above it every time. He makes a stand. He speaks his mind. And even before this tournament, he wasn't playing well at Man City. He hadn't played for a while. People are saying, you're not good enough, Raheem. You shouldn't be in the squad, let alone the first 11. And here we are now, 6 games later, and he's probably the player of the tournament thus far.
Well, because I've been reading some stuff and there are so many differing opinions about this guy. And there's lots of people saying that he should be elevated to that level of the elite players in the world. And yet he just doesn't seem to get very much respect at home.
When he broke through, he was 17 years old at Liverpool and he was playing very well. But you know what? He was a father. He had a kid. So therefore, judgment. Young black guy, multimillionaire with kids at a young age, you know, all this racial rhetoric was just thrown at him. And it was, I mean, that's 10 years ago now. I'd like to think we've come forward from there. I'm not sure we have, but he's faced all that prejudice from the media and from the fans. And it's been so unfair, but on the field, he's never let you down. He's always been that great player and he should be considered world-class, one of the best in the world. Bad stint at Man City. But you don't play at Man City under Pep Guardiola on a regular basis and win championships without being a very good footballer. So I'm so happy for him. And I hope that England celebrate him as they should, because he's one of those. Him and Marcus Rashford are the two players in England who have done so much off the field socially for social justice that they should get that credit.
And Rashford can't even get on the pitch.
No, he can't. Yeah, he's not played well at all for a couple of years, but he's been so involved off the field in these other campaigns. The big thing for him was during COVID when the government pulled school meals because kids weren't in school. He goes, right. I grew up depending on those meals just because I'm not at school. He actually got the government to force change. He talks to Boris Johnson on a regular basis, which, hey, good for you, Rashford. It can't be much fun, but
he's
a great man.
Just one more question. I wish, first of all, the English only subbed one in the game against Denmark, which was surprising when you consider the Danes. Man, the Danes looked exhausted. But Sancho didn't play. I was surprised. He was so good against the Ukraine.
Yeah, he was, but... You know, Gareth Southgate has been criticized for 5 years now about his tactical acumen. Is he too conservative, right? But in this tournament in particular, every decision he's made has been right. And Jadon Sancho is the cool, hip, young kid in Germany. Don't know too much about him, but he bosses the Bundesliga. He should be starting, right? Well, he wasn't starting for whatever reason. And he played against Ukraine, looked fantastic. But against Denmark, a different beast entirely. He doesn't defend. He's a one-on-one type player. He's going to be great in the future for England. Great for Manchester United, who's just signed for. But in that position right now for England, for the first time in my life, you have four or five close to world-class options. You know, you really can't go wrong. Jack Grealish, Phil Foden, Mason Mount, Jadon Sancho, Marcus Rashford. There's a lot of talent there.
And what did Grealish play? About 14 minutes yesterday?
Well, he was subbed on.
Right.
And then subbed off. Yeah. Which generally speaking, is the worst thing for a footballer. Very embarrassing, but it's a tactical decision, right? They scored the goal, and Southgate wouldn't defend. So let's defend. Let's pull him off. Get a more defensive player on. And tactically, it made sense. And post-match, the reports are that he told Southgate, don't worry, Gaffer. I understand. It's okay. We're in the final. So that, again, shows the collective of this team compared to the arrogance of the past.
We're with James Sharman. So it's England and Italy. I assume you made some predictions before this thing started.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah.
Portugal and who?
France.
You had Portugal and France? Well, and I don't say this to embarrass you, Sharman, although I'm not above that. I do it just to try and understand how surprising it is for these two teams to be in this final.
You know what? It's not shocking per se. You know, entering this tournament, for me, there were three great teams. You got France, you got Portugal, you got Belgium, right? And they all hiccuped along the way, didn't have great tournaments from the start. It shows that Europe's perhaps a lot smaller than we think it is. The talent level is coming closer and closer. There were issues off the field with France. Portugal, tactically, they were so dependent on Ronaldo when perhaps they shouldn't have been. And Belgium lost to a really good Italian team, you know, as simple as that. They could have won that game. So it's tough to predict, which is why I hate predictions. They're so difficult. So many narratives within, you know, each tournament. But Italy and England were seen, I think, on the same kind of level entering this tournament. Very good teams who could make a long run if everything goes right. But to win it, it's a bit of a surprise, yeah.
All right, with just one more question, Bob, about the Danes, because I have to ask about the Danes all the time. With the Christian Eriksen event early in the tournament, what will be the legacy of this tournament for Denmark?
I think we'll look back, and outside of England or Italy, they'll be the image of this tournament.
So like Iceland in the World Cup that year?
I think so. But I mean, listen, Denmark, even entering this tournament, were considered a very good team and a dark horse to go a long way. So the semifinals wasn't a massive shock to get this far, given the draw. But what they went through, of course, has made them legends, and how they used that as their fuel to get through some pretty tough games. I think looking back, this is Denmark's tournament in many ways. But they didn't quite get there in the end. And, you know, they're everyone's backup team, I think, in the end. But it started off so horribly, this championship, because of what happened to Eriksen, but it's ended so well on so many levels with some great football being played. I think it's been a great championship.
We are used to, in North America, rivalries being a topic of consideration all the time, whether you get to the postseason or during a course of a regular season. And rivalries tend to be, not always, but they're one of two things. They're either geographic or they're historic. Teams that have played each other multiple times in the past in important games, that becomes a rivalry. Teams that are close geographically, that becomes a rivalry. Italy-England, is this a rivalry game?
Not enormously, no. No, England's rivals are, you know, Germany and Scotland. They're the big rivalries, you know, geographically and for many reasons. Italy.
Well, one geographically and one historically.
Has nothing to do with soccer, really.
Yeah, that's fair enough, yeah. And I think it's more for England than Germany, actually, given that, you know, from a footballing sense, Germany have in the past usually beaten England. For Italy, you know, Italy and France is really huge. Just two teams that are generally competing, contending for championships. That's where they meet in the biggest games. You know, Zidane against Materazzi in 2006, the headbutt. You know, these things have grown. So I think Italy's got more footballing-based rivalries. England are just kind of unpopular around Europe and for a few reasons, I guess. So a lot of teams enjoy beating them.
And the comparisons, I listened to three different broadcasts yesterday of the game, and there were enormous comparisons to 66 and to Sir Bobby Moore and everything. Yeah, but that's a World Cup. This is Europe. But are we just trying to find something to hold on to?
I think so, yeah. Listen, Euro's a massive tournament. It really is. But it isn't. Listen, for me personally, not to dismiss it, because I'm not, it's incredible. I love Euro. It's usually the best tournament, but the World Cup's the World Cup. You are the best in the world when you win that thing. Still, mm-hmm. you win Euro, it's great, but there's a couple of teams in South America called Brazil and Argentina. They're not bad. They've got a pretty good history, right? Which is why the World Cup always means a bit more to me personally. But that's not to dismiss, like I said, Euro, which is a very hard tournament to win and great bragging rights.
There are two things that I think we look at in order to predict, analyze what might happen, especially in soccer. Talent and style. Who has the best talent of these two sides?
I would say at the moment, that's a really good question. I would say it's probably England, just about. Very, very close, though. More young talent at the moment, although Italy's got a lot of young talent coming through. But they've got the more grizzled veterans on Italy. I mentioned before, Chiellini and Bonucci at the back in particular. But it's very, very close. But all these teams, all these players play for big clubs in mm-hmm. Italy and England, essentially, playing in the Champions League. England's the best league at the moment, as far as most popular league in the world. I think it's probably the best league just about. But the Italian Serie A has come on a long way after a real down a few years. It's popped back up. It's the highest scoring league in Europe now, which is surprising, I think, to a lot of people who assume that Italian football is just, you know, defense first. Yeah. Not anymore. There isn't much to choose between them. I think it's very close. England perhaps just have the edge talent-wise.
Who's deeper?
What style?
Who's deeper?
Deeper going forward is England still. Yeah. At the back, it's Italy. And from a style standpoint, you know, it's interesting because Italy, I mentioned before, so renowned for being defensive, you know, and this Catenaccio, which is what they is their bread and butter for so many years. This new manager, Roberto Mancini, he's transformed everything. They're now an attacking unit. They can play defensively very, very well. In fact, they had like 12 games without conceding a goal. But they can attack. They're more comfortable attacking, and they play a very modern style of football. There's a great actually article in The Athletic explaining what they're doing now, and we're evolving to a place where there's no more formations in football. Each player will just operate in a particular area on the field and forward, back, and you have to be it was really like the evolution of total football with the Dutch. That's what Italy's doing right now, which I think is fascinating. England are a bit more structured perhaps than that, but not far off. They're progressive as well. But from a stylistic standpoint, Italy have the edge.
All right. Whose style wins this thing?
You know what?
Does style play a bigger role than talent?
Well, here's the thing. Despite Italy having more style than England, I really think they might revert back to that defensive park-in-the-bus system against England as they did against Spain. The reason being that, without getting too into tactics and being too boring, the Italy back line isn't as mobile as the England front line. So if you play further up the field with the pace England have out wide with Sterling, with Saka, or whoever it's going to be, they could really burn those slower defenders. So they might sit back and trust Bonucci and Chiellini again to kind of guide the ship. So you might see England with possession and Italy hope to kind of break on the counter where they have, you know, some wonderful players, Insigne, Immobile. These are very, very good players. Jorginho in the middle of the park, who's a Chelsea player, knows all the English players so, so well. And he's been, if not Sterling, he's been maybe the best player of this tournament. Very calculated in his moves. Well, so who's going to win it? Thanks, Bob.
Well, it would just before you give your answer, with that in mind, talk about the other end, the English defenders versus the Italian offense.
Well, you know, English defenders, Harry Maguire and John Stones are the centre-backs if they play a four and not a three at the back. Very good experienced players, but still young. They're not Chiellini and Bonucci just yet. And there's still a couple of question marks on them. And out wide, they got some very good attacking players if they play Kyle Walker at right back and Luke Shaw at left back. Again, there might be space behind them potentially. So, it's going to be fascinating if we go with a four or a three if you're Italy, or if you're a four or three if you're England. We're going to find out game day because both teams can play both systems pretty well. I'm not a tactics guy. Generally speaking, they confuse me. You know, I'm watching 22 guys run around in a field and go, geez, man, this is a little bit challenging for me. But in the end, I think it's going to be a coin flip. I think Italy have the edge just about from experience and just what they've been the best team so far at Euro. They've played the best football so far. So I'll give them the slight edge, but honestly, this could go either way.
Well, we know who you'll be cheering for and understand.
100%.
Maybe a question of equal significance will be, will your compatriots back in Britain behave themselves?
No chance.
Either way.
Either way.
There's absolutely no chance.
No chance. I'm quite sure you're right. Which would be more concerning and disturbing for the gendarmes, a victory or a loss by England? Which would create?
Oh, a loss would be more concerning for sure, because that's when the innate anger built up in us Englishmen would just come out. You know, if they win, there'll be some stupidity for sure, but it'd be drunken stupidity. You know, some naked dancing in fountains, that kind of stuff. Maybe a couple of buses rolled over. You know, little things like that. But it'd be more of a good-natured riot as opposed to a riot fueled by hate.
And the COVID protocols wouldn't wait until July 19th.
Yeah. Did you see Wembley yesterday?
I know.
What protocols?
Well, at least the Prime Minister announced it before the game started.
Oh, when I see Boris Johnson wearing an England shirt, I'm just going to turn the TV off. Like, my God.
Don't check Twitter today then, James.
Oh, no, really?
Oh, yeah.
Is he wearing one?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no. There we go.
How's the pie business?
It's going well, thanks. Yeah, it's good. It's good. Yeah, onwards and upwards. We've got lots of plans coming up, more delivery zones, and it's a lot of fun.
Okay, but give your website. What's the website? Come on.
Shamansproper.ca. And yes, we have two locations, and we deliver, of course, across the GTA and soon beyond there as well.
I the last time we had you on, I hadn't tried it. You were kind enough to send a few over, and they were gone, like, in no time. Every one of them was delicious, even the ones I thought, well, I don't know if I'm going to like this one. Every one of them was fantastic. Congratulations. It's a really, really good
thank you, guys. Product. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate that.
Getting out of having job security and getting out of this business, that's a smart move, James.
Yeah, no kidding. It's a little bit volatile.
A little. James Sharman, enjoy the game. And we'll talk to you down the road sometime, I know.
Thanks, fellas. Always enjoy it. Cheers.
Back after these messages. So our thanks to James Sharman once again for joining us.
Will you watch?
When's the game? Saturday?
Sunday, I think.
Sunday?
Yeah.
No NFL game?
No.
Who are the Blue Jays playing on the weekend? But I mean, these are all the questions I have to ask in order to make an honest assessment.
And there's probably a good tennis match going.
Sunday?
Can you imagine? There'll be tennis on Sunday, won't there? Sure. How about the men's final?
I never know. Wimbledon doesn't play on the mid-Sunday, but do they play on the last Sunday?
Oh, yeah, I think so. So how about yesterday, though, in London? You know, it'd be exciting for us because of the Canadians playing. But at one end of the city, at Wimbledon, Roger Federer is getting booted out quickly, but it's still Roger Federer. And then at night at Wembley, you know, England's playing against the Danes.
Well, they had a pretty busy day.
What a day. I mean, I'm not sure there was very much getting done yesterday in London.
And the Open Golf Championship is looming now too.
Royal St. George's?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have an opinion on this soccer thing? It would be stupid of me to offer any opinion.
No, I don't know enough about it. I must admit though.
You watch some.
I've enjoyed watching England play. Watching them play Ukraine was fascinating to see them explode in the second half. And the Spaniards to me, I was not a rooting interest, but I felt the Spaniards got robbed on Tuesday because they played such a more aggressive game. It was more fun to watch for a layman, and they came away with nothing. And didn't get to the Euro final.
Well, we will see what tomorrow shall bring, but perhaps we will, given Shapovalov's imminent appearance in the semifinal, mm-hmm. although the hill to climb next is a significant one. It's more of a mountain than a hill going up against Djokovic. But it's probably worth a conversation, but we'll see what we can dig up in terms of...
Hopefully the person assigned can do the job and get it done.
You always hope, but one can never be sure. Again, we thank James Sharman. Thank you, Shannon, for...
on my way to get pies.
Good for you. Pick some up for me.
He delivers to your house.
Well, he did deliver to my house.
They deliver everywhere in Toronto.
Yes, I know. But if you pick up the pies on the way here, then you can pick up the dog food and cat food.
See,
I'm just trying to combine things for you so that all members of your family are festively fed.
Oh, festively fed. I was going to say
you and Mickey and the animals would all be.
I thought you meant happy. Remember, my wife is Danish. She's not happy. So.
Well, I'm sympathetic to her.
You are all the time.
Less to you.
Yes.
That's it for us. Enough. We'll see you tomorrow. Goodbye, everybody.